Hello everyone and welcome to the Cure Panel Talk Show. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India, and I welcome all of you this evening for a discussion on multiple sclerosis. The Cure Panel Talk Show is broadcast live on Block Talk Radio and brings together experts and patients for a discussion on important topics in healthcare and medical research. We are excited to conduct our second episode of our talk series on multiple sclerosis. In our previous episode, we discussed the various treatment options for progressive multiple sclerosis with Dr. Patricia Coyle of Stony Brook University Medical Center. Today, we are discussing the many invisible symptoms of multiple sclerosis and their management. According to the National MS Society, as of 2001, 350,000 people living in the U.S. have multiple sclerosis. It is estimated that about 33% of people living with MS use a wheelchair most of the time. Not everyone living with MS has a disability, nor are they disabled. Yet, for those who are debilitated, we need to realize that a disability is not always visible. Whether or not a person living with MS uses a cane, walker, or wheelchair, one of the biggest complaints is that people assume they are feeling good because they are told they look good. Many with MS have difficulty working and performing duties of daily living because of the invisible symptoms such as extreme fatigue, pain, weakness, exhaustion, and cognitive impairments. Today we are going to discuss many invisible symptoms of MS and how to manage them with our very distinguished neurologist and MS expert, Dr. Barry Singer. Dr. Singer practices neurology at Missouri Baptist Medical Center in St. Louis and is the director of the MS Center for Innovations in Care. He remains in the BJC Medical Group and on staff at the Barnes Jewish Hospital in St. Louis. He has been an investigator in more than 20 clinical trials focused on new multiple sclerosis treatment options since 1994 and continues to publish in the field of multiple sclerosis. Welcome to the show, Dr. Singer.
Well, thank you so much, Priya, for having me on. Well, good evening, everyone. We have an esteemed panel with us. Are we going to introduce our panel now?
Sure. Thank you very much, Dr. Singer. This is Bradley Mann, and I'd like to welcome everyone to our show tonight. We are going to, as Priya said, we're going to be discussing the many invisible symptoms of multiple sclerosis and their management. I will be your host tonight. I'm Bradley Mann, and I've been just a little bit about myself. I've been living with MS for over 10 years. I've been writing a column for Everyday Health called Sleeping with MS, and it gets that title because not only am I living with progressive MS, I also have a second neurological illness called narcolepsy, so it's a little bit play on words. And, you know, we're really fortunate to have you here, Dr. Singer, and we really appreciate all your time and support for all those impacted with MS. And we also
Thank you so very much, Brad, for taking over. Dr. Singh, I'm so sorry. I think I dropped my call there in between. And I would like to introduce Brad, actually. He's our co-host for the show, and he was diagnosed with mild MS at the age of 35. Brad and his wife, Robin, have recently launched a website, sleepingwithms.com, and they also blog about life with MS, narcolepsy, and a busy family with four children on Everyday Health. On the panel, we have multiple sclerosis patients and advocates. I welcome Melissa Cook, a former school district administrator and teacher from rural Alaska. Melissa Cook is now on medical disability and blogging Monday to Friday about her multiple sclerosis story and the latest MS research on www.mssymptoms.me, Melissa. Suzanne Robbins is our next panelist. She's a Canadian freelance writer and author of the e-book, Faulty Wiring, Living with Invisible MS. She was diagnosed with relapsing remitting MS in 2001. People are often surprised to learn that she has MS as she is not visibly disabled in any way. Her most challenging symptoms are depression, anxiety, cognitive impairment, sleep disruption, and fatigue. Towards the end of the discussion, we will be answering questions submitted via email. With that, I will now hand over to Brad again, who will begin with the show. Thank you, Brad, and you're on air.
Okay, and thank you again, Priya. So we're so excited to have our show tonight about Invisible MS. The format is not very formal. What we'd like to do is I'm going to open a discussion with Dr. Singer, and at times I may ask Melissa or Suzanne to join in certain points, and then they will later be speaking with Dr. Singer directly as well. And then, like Priya said, towards the end of the call, we will have our listeners as well as some email questions submitted for Dr. Singer. So, Dr. Singer, maybe just to start our discussion, if you could just explain for our audience what actually is multiple sclerosis?
So multiple sclerosis is a disease, and, you know, we think of it as a disease of the nervous system in terms of the brain and spinal cord and the nerves of the eye, the optic nerves. That's your central nervous system, but it's really an immune disease. It's an immune attack on the coatings of the nerves. So on the coating of the nerves of the central nervous system is myelin, and so what happens with MS is your immune system turns on itself, and there becomes an attack on the coating of the nerves on myelin and strips those away. So there's important signals that run down the nerves are now delayed and sometimes disrupted. And with severe injury, there can actually be the nerves actually cut. So what our goal of treatment is to prevent that immune attack onto the nervous system.
Excellent. Very good explanation. You know, the subject of invisible MS is, I think, for myself and the other two panelists, very personal in that, you know, I have some profound disabilities from my MS, but if someone doesn't see the actual cane in my hand, I may look as healthy as the next person. Can you just explain, what are some of the more common invisible MS that you see in your patients and ways that, you know, that, like, what is the cause of those symptoms and ways they go about? I guess we'll just start out. What is the most likely cause and what is the most likely ways you see invisible challenges from MS?
Well, clearly, you know, we get this a lot, that people are cruising along in life and develop MS, and people think, well, if you're not in a wheelchair, you know, it must be not so bad. But they really are not living in the body of someone with MS. Tingling and numbness, sometimes painful sensations, or something you can't visualize. So if someone's legs are both numb or tingling or getting jolts of pain in the face called trigeminal neuralgia, you don't see that. Fatigue, 90% of people with MS have fatigue issues, which can be overwhelmingly tired, like as if you didn't get enough sleep. So is a huge symptom that it's very hard for other people to grasp that and understand that, including sometimes spouses. Memory is an issue. Short-term memory for many people, especially if you have a lot of change on your MRI scan. So short-term memory problems, multitasking problems can make things difficult. And so that's another big symptom that's invisible. Bowel, bladder, sexual dysfunction are not apparent. So when someone's got bladder urgency, got to the brunt of the bathroom, or sometimes bowel urgency or incontinence, you know, you may not be aware of that, what someone's struggling with, but that's a huge issue. So these are probably the major symptoms that, you know, are not visible. But there can be more subtle things in terms of distortion of vision. You have blindness out of one eye, and no one can really know that unless they ask. So there are many symptoms that people struggle with and make it hard to get through a day, you know, and some days are worse than others, but it may not be apparent when someone's looking at you. You say, well, you look fine, so what's the issue? And then clearly anxiety and depression or other issues that come up. So, you know, really a huge part of my day, and I just wrapped up seeing patients today, is kind of focusing on those symptoms that are really disrupting quality of life and trying to address those.
I think that's a great point you made. The quality of life is the key, because those symptoms that you just mentioned, and I'd like to explore a few of them further, really, you know, disrupt quality of life just as much as the inability to walk properly does. You know, as far as, like you mentioned, cognitive challenges, I mean, you know, there's a great deal of apprehension in young adults, you know, especially when they start having significant problems with memory or executive functioning issues. Can you just explain, though, how these challenges, and I'm talking about for a typical, actually, there is, of course, there is no typical MS patient, so I take my word back, but more commonly, how do these challenges in MS differ from other cognitive challenges, such as in Alzheimer's disease and other similar conditions?
Well, fortunately, MS cognitive impairment rarely hits the level of Alzheimer's disease. Occasionally I see that. Occasionally I see someone come in, diagnose them in the late 60s, early 70s, and they've had very aggressive disease for a long time that was not controlled or not diagnosed, and they have significant profound memory problems, but that's pretty uncommon in my practice. Most people have some degree of short-term memory impairment. In fact, I just did I had a patient program last night, and we had a patient who had been living with MS and for about 12 years, and she was telling her story, and then all of a sudden she goes, "Did you see that?" And there's a bubble above my head where my thought just disappeared. So that's which I thought, you know, and in the audience it was very heartwarming. Many people in the audience said, "Yeah, that happens to me," you know, like the thought just escapes. So it's trying to keep your focused, trying to keep your when multiple things are going on, distractions, people at work telling you things verbally at a meeting and you're not being able to write them down. So that cognitive processing is what really gets disrupted with MS. And it's very different. I mean, I have people with profound physical disability. They're totally intact cognitively, and because their spinal cord's affected and their brain is not as much. But people with that, the more disease that we see on the MRI, it seems to correlate with that cognitive dysfunction. And frankly, you know, a lot of people on disability are because of that cognitive impairment and fatigue issues. And sometimes that can sneak up. So it really, controlling the disease is really important to try to prevent that from getting worse.
Yeah, those absolutely. You know, my physician recently had referred for like some testing to determine the extent and ways and treatment options. Do you recommend things like neuropsych testing for your patients? And how would you recommend, like you mentioned, multitasking? That's one of my biggest difficulties. Like as you're talking, I'm literally taking notes to follow up my next question. And how do you recommend people to deal with those type of problems?
Well, neuropsych testing can definitely help define what the deficits are. I mean, they're pretty typical in MS for most people. Again, it tends to be the multitasking ability, switching gears, primarily the short-term memory. So there's a certain pattern that shows up very typically for people with MS. Not everyone's different. Some people are different. I have some people that have, you know, primarily word-finding difficulties. But most people, it's fairly similar. Where the neuropsychological testing comes into play, first of all, it helps to define it for someone that is considering disability. They're having really trouble at work and really defining that. Unfortunately, it's expensive and cumbersome to do it on a regular basis to follow along with how people are doing. But we ask those questions. I find it's very sensitive to talk to people about how are they doing at work or how are they doing at home with their spouse or the significant others in the room, and talking about how well are you functioning and what kind of cognitive problems are you having. So most people can kind of explain what's going on. And then I find that occupational therapy can definitely help. So if you're living with deficits, particularly people that are not organized, the occupational therapy can be huge in terms of coming up with strategies to compensate. I mean, I know people that run companies that have no short-term memory because they're highly organize living with MS. So that's really the key is now we can make accommodations in the workplace for some people. So let's say you work in a cubbyhole and it's in a place that's near the copier and a lot of foot traffic. We can write letters like, can we get you in a place where, you know, you can focus on one task at a time and not a lot of distractions. So we try to make some accommodations and write these letters for the workplace to help that out. The other things that are useful is smartphones are extremely helpful to keep things organized. Emails, you know, if you're working on different projects or, you know, you have kids activities and you're trying to keep your family life together, you know, putting things in emails and folders and keeping that all organized is extremely helpful. Having one family calendar, having spouses write down lists instead of verbally telling, you know, what you need to do or what you need to take care of around the house. All those things can make a huge difference in terms of quality of life.
Yeah, those are all great suggestions. I mean, I've only in the last year really come to appreciate the benefits of the using the smartphone of, because, you know, I'm great at making lists and then forgetting where I put them. So.
Right. Right, that's the advantage of the smartphone. We've come a long way because people used to use binders, and you know it's hard to carry that all around. But if you have it plugged in and you sync your calendars with those that need to be in the know, it makes a big difference.
Yeah, a huge difference. And also, I found recently that my smartphone also has a voice recorder built in. So, you know, when I just want to get the information down without taking the time to type it and whatnot, I found that for myself has really worked also.
Yeah, and I find that particularly people that have visual impairment or
yes,
problems with hand coordination, that can be much faster.
Absolutely. Great point. So I guess this sort of segues in, you know, with talking about fatigue, because of course, fatigue can aggravate cognitive challenges, but Do we know why fatigue is so pervasive and widespread in MS?
Well, there seems to be a number of reasons why. One is when the immune system is revved up, the immune system is in overdrive with MS, the immune cells do secrete chemicals that can cause cytokines, which can cause you to feel tired. For example, when you have an infection, your immune system ramps up, a viral infection. It's your immune system that's creating this sense of fatigue and worn out. It's not necessarily the virus, but it's also part of your immune system reacting. So, in fact, some people, when they find their MS is under control, that they have less fatigue. We definitely see with flare-ups there's more fatigue. So that's one of the issues. Another issue is basically brain function. So if part of your brain is not working and other areas have to take over, and maybe, you know, maybe putting your brain on over, you know, your brain's overfunctioning and requiring more neurons, different areas of the brain to kick in. So we know from functional MRI, a type of MRI scan, that if one area is not working, then many other areas have to take over. So that may be playing a role. We definitely know some of our medications, for example, interferons can cause fatigue. Some medications can cause fatigue, so that can be playing a role as well. Sometimes it's side effects of the medication. So there seems to be a number of different factors that come into play. But we'd say about 90% of people with MS have fatigue. And, you know, you can define fatigue different ways. You know, most fatigue we're talking about, like when you wake up in the morning, you still feel tired. But sometimes it's motor fatigue, that your legs are just weak and and it's just that much harder to get across the parking lot and go shopping and then get home, and then you're just worn out because physically you've done a lot. But then there's also, like, you feel like you didn't get enough sleep. And so both of those are big issues. Now, we have strategies to deal with this. One is if, let's say, you're on disability and you're not working, then take a nap in the afternoon. Set your alarm clock so you can sleep, you know, so don't make the nap a 2-hour nap or 3-hour nap, make it a 1-hour nap. do physical exercise in the morning. So if you're traveling or you got a busy weekend, you can do the physical exercise in the morning, and then in the afternoon, take a break and rest. So this is more like energy conservation. Some people definitely exercise. So exercise on a regular basis in clinical trials has shown to reduce fatigue. I get a little pushback. Well, if I'm so tired, how am I going to work and then exercise? But if
sure.
you do it in the morning, it makes a big difference. And then we got medications. But sometimes we go to medications because it's just really what we need to do to so people can have improved quality of life.
Yeah, I found for myself the combination of the medication and, like you said, energy conservation or fatigue management. I mean, naps I found for myself really are effective. Of course, I also have narcolepsy, so it's a little hard to figure out where one illness ends and the next one begins. But you mentioned also about, like, motor fatigue. I've seen, like, in physical therapy with people with MS, and I get this myself as well, it's like you might start doing an exercise and you seem to be doing it fine, but after just several repetitions, you sort of get like a muscle fatigue of the same, holding it in the same way. Is that similar to what you're saying about motor fatigue?
Yeah, it's on the same thing. And it just means that frankly, when people have to walk or their arms weak and you have to use it over and again, then, it's a lot more energy to get around if your leg is weak. If you're dragging a weak leg around and your other limbs are strong, I mean, it's going to expend a certain amount of energy, more energy than someone that does not have MS or does not have physical disability. So, yeah, you definitely see fatigue if you repetitively do use a limb in exercise or physical therapy, you're going to get weaker. And just like the same thing if you're out there walking or using your arm on a regular basis and you've got a weak arm. So that's a little different than, just feeling tired. And a big reason why a lot of people have fatigue and MS is they just don't sleep well. So sleep issues are extremely common. And a lot of times this is anxiety, you can't go to sleep, your mind's racing, and all those things that were going on during the day, you just can't shut your mind off. So that's one of the reasons a lot of people with MS have, because of the mobility issues, can gain weight, and then they can develop obstructive sleep apnea, which means like you're snoring at night and you stop breathing, and that can be treated and give you lots of energy. Some people have restless legs, and that disrupts your sleep. So a lot of times the first thing I ask if you're having fatigue is, are you sleeping? How's your sleep? And sometimes if we fix the sleep, the fatigue's much better. So it's not always just the MS.
And do you refer, if needed, do you refer your patients for, like, overnight sleep studies to determine
yes,
the
yes.
cause?
Yeah. And I find frequently it's restless legs or sleep apnea. In fact, I had someone today that's what we found. So, sometimes we can fix that sleep issue and then people have a lot more energy.
Yeah, absolutely. And it worked for me, so I highly recommend that. We just move on to, I just wanted to talk about, like, the invisible symptom of pain. We talked about that just briefly earlier. But, early in the course of my MS, I was erroneously told by someone that since MS is often an absence of feeling, that there is no pain ever possible.
That ain't true.
Exactly. Of course we know that it's completely untrue. And
hang out in my office. I don't think that would be hearing that from most people.
I want to strangle the person at the time.
I mean, some people, yes. I mean, there are a lot of people that are pain-free. But a lot of people do live with nerve pain, so burning, pins and needles, tingling, it can be both legs and torso, it could be one side of your face, so a lot of people do live with it. And then occasionally I see people, fairly commonly, will just have these random jolts of pain, maybe repetitively in the same place on the back of the scalp or various areas of the body. So we definitely see quite a bit, and then trigeminal neuralgia is electrical shocks. shooting sensations in the face, which can be extremely painful. In fact, people that have trigeminal neuralgia say it's worse than natural childbirth or kidney stones from those that have had both. So, you know, these are definitely ways that we can treat this. You know, we tend to use the drugs Neurontin, Lyrica, Trileptal, Topamax, Cymbalta. So these are the various medications that we have for neuropathic pain.
Yeah, I can, as one who suffers from trigeminal neuralgia, it is truly, and I've had back surgery and many other things, and it's truly some of the worst pain I've ever had. And it comes on so suddenly, you know, it's
either
this stabbing, burning type pain that, and you just, you know, there's nothing you can do until it goes away, you know, of course, with the medicine.
Yeah, but there's even surgical procedures that can be done. So we can get that under control. It's generally, it's just a matter of finding the right combination of medications.
Yes, absolutely. I agree. It does take time, but I can test it. It does get under control. Do we know what causes nerve pain in MS?
Well, it's pathways. So neurology is a lot like electrical wiring. So there's certain areas of the brain that affect sensation. Often it's the back part of the spinal cord called the dorsal columns. There's some deep brain areas in the brain that control sensation. So it's a lot about territory and where that immune attack hits. If it hits one of the sensory pathways, it can lead to the debilitating pain. Trigeminal neuralgia usually comes out of the brainstem, part of the brainstem called the pons. And so, you know, it's all about where that immune attack hits, and it's kind of random where MS strikes.
Yeah, it's quite true. Okay, so going on to it. Next question is about vision. I guess why is vision difficulty so common in MS, and why are eyes so susceptible to attacks from MS?
Well, it's considered, you know, it's definitely the optic nerve is the only nerve that actually, cranial nerve, that gets hit directly from MS, and it's considered in some ways part of that central nervous system. So you basically have, it's very vulnerable to an immune attack, and so we see that pretty commonly. So optic neuritis would cause pain with eye movements frequently, and then visual loss, and often central visual loss, or people describe a shade being pulled over their eye. And it tends to go on for, you know, it might be a week, a couple months, it could be permanent. And then double vision happens because of the brainstem. So if the brainstem gets affected, then people see two, or shaky eye movements. So that tends to be more the brainstem. So there's a lot of territory that makes people vulnerable. So generally, you know, if you have an acute attack of visual loss or a brainstem attack, treatment with IV steroids is really the way to go, and often people respond pretty dramatically with steroids.
And do you, at what point do you recommend your patients that they would consult with like a neuro-ophthalmologist in addition to working with you to treat eye problems?
Yeah, I mean, definitely we use neuro-ophthalmologists for a few reasons. One, you know, definitely people that have recurrent optic neuritis, you know, it's good to have them fouled over time to make sure that they're not losing further ground. Particularly, there's a variant of MS called neuromyelitis optica for those individuals. Often people are referred to a neuro-ophthalmologist gets involved pretty quickly because it's often an ophthalmologist that sends them to the neuro-ophthalmologist even before they come to an MS doctor. And but we also use neuro-ophthalmologists for double vision, for correction of double vision, to take a look, and to help us follow patients. And particularly, there's some patients that have more than one ocular phenomenon. So we definitely pull them into as part of the team for people with optic neuritis issues.
Yeah, I found them to be the combination of the two as a team has worked wonders for myself. Just one more question before I go on to the next panelist. this is a condition that I sometimes suffer, and I don't ever hear it discussed very much, and I was just curious how often you see basically speaking difficulties with MS, you know, periods of incredible hoarseness, like stammering, getting words out and things like that. How common are that, and what strategies do you recommend to your patients to treat that?
Yeah, I don't see a lot of it. And I'm definitely slurred speech would be the most common thing that I see. So some people have slurred speech. It tends to be more, again, brainstem if there's no facial weakness. And then, you know, definitely, you know, some people have stammering. And the question is stammering more stuttering? Is it more, which I don't see very much. There's always word-finding problems and trouble coming out of it, which is more cognitive than actual mechanical. But probably the best, definitely the best approach for this would be a speech therapist to work on that. And it may be in the middle of a relapse or more chronic and coming up with a way to be able to enunciate better and to learn those techniques to overcome those challenges when they do occur.
Okay, very good. Great advice. Okay, next I'd like to go on Melissa Cook. Are you online?
I'm on the line.
Okay, Melissa, great to speak with you. And would you like to just tell us a little bit about yourself and your questions for Dr. Singer?
Okay, well, as was introduced at the beginning, I am a former school district administrator and former school teacher. So one of my first questions actually is related to my background. I have 4 degrees, 2 bachelor's, 2 master's degrees. I was just short of my PhD when MS affected the automation of my heart and lungs, and I went out on medical disability. One of the things that they did in my testing for memory issues in the past is they sent me to have some memory tests done, and I was put in a room where there were no other distractions. It was quiet. It was an all-day test. They gave me a list of 26 words. I could probably tell you half of them or more today because each word that came, I built a picture in my mind because I know memory strategies. It's part of my education is to know how to teach other people how to learn. And when we were done, I aced the test. But at the same time, I could be talking to somebody for 15 minutes, go around the corner in a store, I mean, this actually happened, be looking at something else, and they come over to give me one more comment, and I don't know who they are, and no recollection of the conversation. So my question is, when are there alternative memory exams methods for identifying memory issues in patients who are highly trained in memorization?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, there's definitely, you know, there's different types of also memory. So there's visual memory, there's verbal memory, and then there's different types of testing situations, and depending on how much time they gave you, you know, if they gave you more time than a typical neuropsychological, do they do a full panel of neuropsychological testing or a, Yeah, so normally if you do a full neuropsychological panel, it's usually about 4 hours of testing, and they go across the whole spectrum of tasking. And it seems like what the issue is more multitasking, that easily when you have distraction, you lose that bank of information that you had just obtained, and that when you get distracted, then you can't hold on to it. And obviously, if you're focused in a quiet room and you're only focused on one task, there's no multitasking needed in that condition. And I think that's part of what happens with MS is that we have these myelinated neurons that go, you know, obviously some go down your spine and out to your limbs for motor, but there's so many more neurons that are involved in the interconnections from different areas of the brain that help us to cognitively process images and words. So if you're seeing a word, then it goes to a semantic area of your brain, but then you're also picking up a visual image of that object. So different parts of your brain are involved and helping to restore that short-term memory thought. But with distraction, with, you know, as you mentioned, like you're driving or you have some kind of distraction, then you're going to lose that information is not going to be hardwired in. So definitely it's hard to come up with strategies to deal with multitasking. And in a busy school-like setting, it's very hard to have total focus unless you got your own office, and you don't have phone calls coming in left and right, and you're working on one task. So I think that's where people really get challenged. And I see this over and over again out in the real world. It's very hard to have a well-controlled situation. Sometimes the people that work from home actually have more success with this, depending on if you don't have three kids and two dogs at home, it's easier. But if there's a lot of distractions, it's going to make things very hard. But again, you know, a full neuropsych testing would probably pick up that deficit, I would imagine.
Okay. I have an interesting vision issue that when I describe to my neurologist, she says, that doesn't sound like MS. So she sends me to the neuro-ophthalmologist, and he does a thorough eye exam and says, it doesn't look like it's the eye. It has to be the message going to the brain for MS. And the symptom that I have is that I see double vertically in just one eye. I see double side to side. But if I close my right eye, my left eye only sees double, one on top of the other. It's very clear. A zero will look like an eight.
And do you wear contacts or anything?
No,
glasses?
I don't. No.
So generally, double vision out of one eye tends not to be directly an MS-related symptom. The reason is that MS, to get double vision, that means the eyes are not lined up correctly. So one of the most common things is maybe like impairment of one of the nerves to the eye from the brainstem, and it may have one eye that won't look out to the right. And so let's say if you're looking straight ahead, your right eye won't move out to the right-hand side. So there's an impairment. The alignment of the eyes is not correct, and that gives you double vision. And so there's different types of eye abnormalities, but it's usually the double vision comes from not being lined up. It tends to be actually more horizontally displaced, where the images are side by side than up and down, but you can get vertically displaced images. But again, with MS, if you cover one eye, it goes away. Now, other things can cause double vision out of one eye. Sometimes cataracts, sometimes the front of the eye, cornea issues can do it. But it's pretty rare, you know, a brain problem outside of the brainstem shouldn't really cause vertical double vision out of one eye. So, yeah, I don't have a great explanation for that if they don't find anything else in your full ophthalmologic exam.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'm going to call it a mystery then.
Yeah, it sounds like a bit of a mystery. You're not the first person that's still double out of one eye, but I've seen that before, but I don't know. It's hard to figure that out physiologically.
When I go into the doctor's office and I sit down with either my primary or my neurologist, I feel self-conscious when I tell them that I have these symptoms going on. I walk fine. Most often I speak fine. Anybody else looking at me would say that I have a clean bill of health, and I know this when I look at myself, and I know when I'm sitting there what I look like. I have that third eye ability to see me, and coming from an education background where we look for evidence, we look for test scores, we look for proof, and here I am sitting in the doctor's office, and I'm on medical disability, and what they write determines whether or not I'm going to stay on medical disability. And I look great, and I tell them, can't remember the person I just talked to in the store, having a problem stirring the pot when I'm cooking. I have fatigue to the point where, you know, it disrupts my day and I can't get the tasks done. I mean, you name it. I have all the MS symptoms at different times in my life. And so how do you, what advice do you have for patients who are concerned about the invisibility of their MS symptoms, even when they're sitting with their doctor?
Well, I mean, usually, you know, you got to have an open and interactive conversation. I mean, the communication's got to be really important. I mean, when we go through people's symptoms and what's going on with them. I mean, we talk about all these invisible symptoms of MS that we were just talking about, the fatigue, the memory problems, the sensory problems. Many of my patients have a normal neurologic examination when I see them, but I know they're struggling with all kinds of different issues. So generally, your neurologist, I mean, primary care may not necessarily get it, but your neurologist should get the symptoms that you're dealing with and that you're coping with. And it's not a one-to-one, and people can have new symptoms or new attacks, and we don't see a change on the MRI scan. So it's not, there's a lot of these invisible symptoms of MS that, you know, I take it face value when a patient tells me they're experiencing these things. I don't think they're making it up. I think it's legitimate, and we got to come up with a game plan to tackle it and deal with it. And so they should be listening. I mean, you know, in my opinion, if you don't feel like you can be open and have that candid conversation with your neurologist and they're not responsive to you or blowing you off, then that's not a good relationship. So we really do need to focus on those symptoms that you're experiencing and come up with a game plan for them.
Okay. I think it's more of an internal issue for me. People always tell me, boy, you look great.
Yeah.
When I'm not feeling great, I don't come out to play. So they don't see
right.
that.
Right. I think that's part of the problem is just a lack of education. So, and that's what really helps to bring friends along or significant others, especially if you go to a patient program or you're in Alaska, right? So
yeah.
I don't know if you have access, you know, obviously there's a lot of rural areas of Alaska where you can't really just go out to some patient program and be around with people with them, you know, with other people with MS. And so a lot of family members or significant others really know very little about the disease and they don't really get it. And all of a sudden they come to a program, a patient program, or they get involved and like, whoa, you know, and they hear what other spouses are going through. And, you know, I think sometimes that it's very eye-opening. But it's hard if you're kind of struggling with all these issues internally and no one else really understands the disease. But education's really, really pretty critical.
Okay.
Melissa, also, I don't know, you know, what resources are near you, but if you can get involved with one of the local chapters of, like, the National MS Society or a similar group, and they have, you know, different educational programs and whatnot, and that may help as well, you know, as far as, like, you know, education to other people. But
great.
Thank you very much. Can we go on to Suzanne now for your questions, please?
Hi, Brad. Happy
Hi,
to be here.
Yes.
I'd just like to pick up on something that Melissa was saying because I could really relate to how she was feeling in talking to her neurologist and to others about her invisible symptoms, because I feel exactly the same way. I've had relapsing remitting MS for more than a decade now, but I'm not visibly disabled. I have bladder issues and cognitive problems and some mild impairments, but you have to watch me pretty closely to see them. Outwardly, I appear perfectly normal. So, in fact, I'm doing so well that it's hard for some people to believe that I'm actually sick. And I think people have preconceived notions about MS and what it's supposed to look like, and I don't match that picture that they have in their heads. There seems to be the assumption that they expect the severity of the symptoms to match the progression of disability. And
mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if Dr. Singer could talk a little bit about the relationship between the presence of these invisible symptoms and the degree of disability and the duration of the disease. Can newly diagnosed people with MS or those who have only minimal mobility impairments experience fatigue and other invisible symptoms to the same degree, say, as those who are significantly impaired with physical mobility problems?
Oh, definitely, definitely. And we know about a third of people with MS, even early on in relapsing remitting MS, have some cognitive issues. So we definitely see we see a split, and there are definitely a lot of people where, in fact, probably more more times than not, the people that end up going on disability in my practice, it's because of fatigue and cognitive issues as opposed to physical disability. Many people with physical disability, unless you have, you know, a job that, you know, you're a you know, mechanic, I got people that work in construction at heights, you know, you got balance issues. That's clearly a big issue where physical disability early on in the disease course may prevent you from doing your job. Many people, in fact, I can think of several patients I saw today where cognition was really the limiting factor and prevented them from holding down a job because of all these issues. So we definitely see this early on. I think we have failed in our clinical trials of highlighting it. There's a lot of discussion about how, you know, do these medications affect cognition, and there's some data out there, but we really didn't study as much as we should have in clinical trials to see the impact of medication. But we do know that if you have less MRI activity, you're less likely to develop cognitive impairment. So one of those things that we definitely see, over 90% of people with MS have fatigue, so fatigue is a huge issue even early on in the disease course. I can tell you that many of my patients that come in had fatigue for 2-3 years even before they developed MS. They'd been to their doctor, they had thyroid tests, they had been worked up, and they couldn't find a cause of fatigue until, boom, you know, they develop numbness on one side of their body. So, you know, there's a strong component of this disease that is just not not very present, you know, not visible to other people, but they're really struggling with it early on in the disease course. And I think it is hard. I mean, I think there's a presumption, MS is a bad disease because people get in a wheelchair, but they don't realize that there's other forms of disability that can be just as devastating or disruptive in one's life.
Right, and they expect that sort of linear progression, you know, from as someone becomes increasingly disabled from a physical perspective, that these other invisible symptoms would move forward in tandem. I think there's that expectation that they're linked somehow,
fatigue for many people actually goes down over time as people more secondary progressive, the immune system's less revved up, so sometimes the fatigue is actually can be even less later on in life. You know, the bladder dysfunction tends to get worse over time for many people as they develop more physical disability. Clearly, many people that are recently diagnosed live with a lot more of those invisible symptoms. And I think we're going to be more aware of that over time. I think you know, we're being more conscious of these things, and I think we need to do a better job of keeping track of the cognition and the sensory symptoms that are under the radar. Particularly as our medications get better, I think we're going to have less people with major physical disability, but some of these underlying symptoms of what people struggle with, pain, tingling, vision impairment, I think we really got to do a better job of addressing and keeping the disease under check.
Do you think these invisible symptoms tend to be overlooked in a standard neurological exam, and if so, why?
Well, they frequently can be. Standard neurologic exam, you know, it's very hard to go through, you know, when a new patient comes in, you might go through a whole bunch of questions in terms of asking past presidents and spelling world backwards and subtracting sevens. You know, so there's some basic stuff that you're going to do in exam, but it's not going to replace entire neuropsychological 4-hour panel of testing. And you're not going to pick up fatigue on an exam. You're not really going to get much in cognition. I can tell you many of my patients that have tingling, pins and needles, and burning, when I put a tuning fork on them and do pinprick sensation, it may be normal. They may not notice a difference, but they're still dealing with symptoms. So, you know, I think and it's hard to tell a bladder dysfunction on a neurologic exam. So, you know, really what's more important to me is that history for these invisible. So it's when I talk to someone, tell me what's going on with you, and then we go through all the different symptoms, sexual dysfunction, bladder, bowel, you know. So we learn more from sitting and talking to someone than necessarily the exam. I think where the exam comes in handy is sometimes there's changes that people aren't aware of, like their leg is much weaker than it was before, and they kind of minimized it, and you picked up something that should be looked at. So sometimes we find some new things on the exam, but most of my information I get is based on someone's history.
So from the patient's perspective, then it's really important to share, even if you feel embarrassed or you're feeling the way Melissa does in interacting with her her physician.
In fact, when I say between us, the priest and the bartender, we've heard it all. sexual bowel, bladder. I mean, we were talking about trouble evacuating bowels and incontinence.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's
all day
hard
long.
For someone, it's hard for someone like me who doesn't look impaired in any way. When I'm sitting in the waiting room for my neurologist, surrounded by people in wheelchairs with walkers and crutches, and I think, oh, my goodness, their problems are so much worse than mine. And then I walk in to, you know, share my, you know, my story, and I feel, well, what do I have to complain about, you know? And yet
my life has been
compromised. Yeah.
Our goal is to keep you out of that chair. And if we don't know if there's changes going on with you, then we can't address that. And many of these symptoms of MS can be very disruptive to quality of life. I mean, sometimes it's bowel incontinence. Well, I use medication sometimes that work for bladder urgency, can work for bowel incontinence. And that's huge. You know, if you save someone from those kinds of problems and you can fix bladder issues, and then the quality of life can go way up. A lot of people with bladder urgency, they don't want to run to the bathroom, so they drink less water, and then they start to get constipated, and it's this vicious cycle. They get dehydrated, and they get fatigued. So, you know, trying to tackle these invisible symptoms can really improve the quality of life. Many patients that have dealt with neuropathic pain, burning, pins and needles, have been able to get rid of with the right medications, and it's huge. Fixed fatigue, and it's huge, and the quality of life goes way up. So it's usually a couple of symptoms, you know, addressing a couple of these silent neurologic symptoms can make big improvements in quality of life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Suzanne. I mean, it sounds like, you know, the really comes down to the doctor-patient relationship is really so key in addressing invisible symptoms, because that communication line has to be there both ways. You know, you have to let your doctor know, and sometimes your doctor has to ask, how is it going, because the patient might be a little hesitant to bring it up. So I think those are all great advice.
And it also depends on how your doctor reacts. You know, the more experience you have with MS, the more strategies that you've picked up. You know, I learned a lot from my patients about what's worked for them over the years. I take care of over 1,500 MS patients and run a large center. So, you know, when you do it on a daily basis, you learn those strategies that, you know, that might work or might not work, or what to try, and you just have to be open to addressing the issues. And we try to do it without medication. Sometimes we need medication, but it's really that interaction and that ability to share options really makes a big difference.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fantastic advice, Priya. I think we have phone callers that are waiting to ask questions for Dr. Singer.
And then I also want to hit just before the end, I also want to hit a little bit about curing MS, because I know this was a cure panel, and then touch on some remyelination updates.
Please, Dr. Singer, please go ahead. I think we have some time, so we can actually talk about a little bit of curing MS.
So one of the, you know, I was very intrigued when I got this invitation from Priya for a cheer panel talk show. Clearly, that's, you know, the mission of the National Multiple Sclerosis Society, why it was founded, and it's clearly our mission is to eventually curing MS. And one of the fronts and the way we need to think about curing it is we don't have a specific virus, so wonderful to have a vaccine that we just give, and then the MS is all taken care of, and people won't get MS anymore. But we don't have a simple infection that seems to be controlling it, and we do know that some people have a genetic background that makes them more susceptible for developing MS. And what we do know is when you have immune cells called lymphocytes, and for a lymphocyte to get turned on to attack the brain and spinal cord and react with myelin, it requires some factors. One of them is your own genetic background on the surface of these cells, and then also something from the environment plays a role. And we know with identical twins, about a third of the twins will have MS. If one has MS, then about a third of the other twin will get MS. And up to two-thirds of the twins will have some white matter change. But even with the exact same genetic background, both sets of twins don't automatically, identical twins don't automatically get MS. So we know there's environmental factors that come into play, such as low vitamin D, smoking at a young age, childhood obesity, particularly in girls, exposure to Epstein-Barr virus. So there's some environmental factors that are coming into play with your own immune system that triggers the MS attack. So what are the strategies? You know, one interesting strategy, there's a company, Opexa, that's had this interesting strategy of taking people's own immune cells and then exposing them to the myelin components and then irradiating these cells and then reinjecting them back. And this is kind of like a personal immune type of procedure. Preliminary data initially, I think they're going to revamp the new trials, but the preliminary data didn't show a benefit in MRI data a few years ago. But new strategies are going to be developed. And I think, you know, this approach, a very personalized approach using someone's own immune system and how the immune attack is being created by your own immune system is going to be important since we don't have a specific environmental trigger. But we really need to focus on, you know, trying to shut down this disease, particularly if you have a family history of MS. You know, can we shut this down earlier? The other exciting front is remyelination. And with remyelination, we're trying to recoat the nerves. And we know in the brains and spinal cords of people with MS that 5 to 8% of the cells in the brain are cells that could potentially be turned into myelin-making cells. The cells that make myelin are called oligos, short for oligodendrocytes. And there are cells within the brain and spinal cord that are immature oligos. And with the right signal, they can turn on and start making myelin and recoat the nerves. Well, a gentleman, a doctor by the name of Moses Rodriguez at the Mayo Clinic has spent 20 years. He's been working on an antibody to turn on myelin production, which worked in animal models. And we've been participating in a phase one clinical trial for remyelination. And there's two other antibodies out there. One's called anti-lingo-1 and another one called anti-semaphorin D, which have also been shown in animal models to create robust new myelin. So one of the exciting fronts is these new antibody therapies that have entered clinical trials for repair. So hopefully one day we'll be able to restore function for people living with MS and hopefully improve not only the physical symptoms of MS that we see, but the visible symptoms, but these invisible symptoms.
Thank you, Doctor. That is very hopeful. I think we have immunology using our own immune system to rectify the issues that MS brings us with. We have a caller online who wants to ask you a question. The person calling in from 650-605, you're on air. Please ask your question.
Yeah. Hi, Dr. Singer. It was a pleasure listening to you all this while. And actually, I was going to ask this question about anti-lingo therapy that you already answered. But I also have this question about erythropoietin. I learned that it is also being studied for improving MS symptoms. So what is the rationale behind that? Because we know that erythropoietin is a hormone that is supposed to promote RBC formation in the bone marrow. So how does that how is it thought to be neuroprotective is my question.
Yeah, well, there's been some research in animal models looking at therapeutic benefits and experimental autoimmune encephalomyelitis in mice. So there has been some animal models that show that it may help prevent inflammation in the nervous system. There's been a few small trials looking at, I think one had about 20 people, 10 on drug and 10 off drug, in addition to steroids for recovery from relapses. So there was one study that was presented, and I think there was another study with optic neuritis that was looking at, you know, recovery from optic neuritis. But they were very small studies. So we, at this point, we don't know exactly, you know, what the, you know, if it's going to have a lasting effect. We know that erythropoietin increases your red blood cells in your circulation, so there may be some consequences that, you know, may not be positive. So we'll have to see if more information comes forward, but there was some preliminary evidence that might help in terms of recovery from a relapse faster.
Okay. Thanks for answering that.
Sure.
We have received some questions via email, Dr. Singer, but I think we have covered almost everything. You've spoken, the panelists have asked you the questions, and I think we've covered almost everything, and the hour is almost done now. Thank you so very much. I think we shared a lot of information with our audience today. Thank you, Dr. Singer, for being with us. It was an absolute pleasure listening to you. And the panel has been wonderful. Brad, Melissa, and Suzanne, thank you so very much for your participation. Our listeners, you can always mail me, priya@chalix.com, with your feedback and suggestions on MS topics that you would like to hear on this talk series. The link for today's broadcast will be sent and shared with all the participants. Please visit yourpanel.carefeed.net for details of our upcoming shows. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. Best wishes.